Hello, greetings. My task in the next 10 minutes is to explain to you why C.S. Lewis refused to write for Christianity Today. I have a facsimile copy of the very first edition of Christianity Today, published in 1956. But in 1955, Carl F.H. Henry, the founding editor of Christianity Today, wrote a letter to C.S. Lewis and asked him to publish a series of articles in Christianity Today. And I want to read to you an excerpt from an article that I published with Christianity Today on this very topic nearly a year ago now. And then I want to offer you my theory, three converging streams of influence in Lewis's life that led to this point in 1955 when he wrote to Carl Henry and told him that he couldn't write for the magazine. I grew up in central Illinois in the middle of corn fields and soybean fields in a small town called Meridosha. I was not all that far from another little town in Illinois by the name of Alton. Alton is in the news all the time. Alton is in the middle of a 35,000-acre floodplain where the Mississippi, Missouri, and Illinois River all come together. I remember growing up and going to a state park. The name of the state park is Pier Marquette. And if you hiked up to a tall point, a high point in the state park, you could look down and see where those three mighty rivers all came together to form this huge river plain. And what I want to do is read an excerpt from my article and then for us to kind of hike up to this high peak in Lewis's life in 1955 and look back to see these three converging influences that led him to tell Carl F.H. Henry no. So here's the excerpt from the article. "I wish your project heartily well," wrote C.S. Lewis to Christianity Today, "but can't write you articles." Carl F.H. Henry, founding editor of the magazine, had in 1955 invited Lewis to contribute to the magazine's first issue. Lewis declined. Henry was not, as the saying goes, a day late and a dollar short. He was over a decade late, and no dollar amount would have mattered as Lewis gave the lion's share of his royalties to charity. There was a time when Lewis would have said yes, namely when Nazi soldiers marched into Poland and threatened the stability of the world. In this sense, Adolf Hitler's influence on Lewis's apologetics is an irrefutable fact. The Führer's evil campaign paved the way for the clear-speaking Lewis to engage listeners of the British Broadcast Service. Even as bombs fell over London, Lewis's baritone voice boomed on radios across Europe. His evangelistic approach was tailor-made for men at war. Thus, Mere Christianity was born in the fullness of time. Published in 1952 from the transcripts of his broadcast talks from the 40s. But by the time the book was available in print, Lewis was already changing his approach. As Solomon said, there is a time for war and a time for peace. Lewis, and I think this is important for us to note, modified his evangelistic methods for both. But supposing, Lewis said, but supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, Lewis later said of the power of fiction to present truth, could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? Lewis thought so. Thus, he focused the rest of his writing career on smuggling theology behind enemy lines. The enemies Lewis now faced were comfort and post-war apathy, and to battle them both, he would strike at his reader's imagination. While Lewis's articulation of the gospel took different paths, they all led to Christ. In so doing, he was able to take aim at both the head and the heart. A C.S. Lewis for the 21st century must learn from his apologetics in times of war and peace. Listen to what C.S. Lewis told a group of youth workers shortly before the end of World War II. Lewis said, "That is why we," and anyone who's done public apologetics will understand what Lewis says here. "That is why we apologists take our lives in our own hands and can be saved only by falling back continually from the web of our own arguments, from Christian apologetics into Christ himself." If Lewis was falling back from his arguments, it can mean only one thing: Aslan was on the move. As C.S. Lewis told Carl Henry in his letter in 1955, this is what Lewis wrote to Carl Henry. "My thought and talent, such as they are, now flow in different, though I trust, not less Christian channels. And I do not think I am at all likely to write more directly theological pieces. The last work of that sort which I attempted had to be abandoned. If I am now good for anything, it is for catching the reader unawares through fiction and symbol. I have done what I could in way of frontal attacks, but I now feel those days are over." I want to offer you kind of my case for why Lewis told Henry no. So these are the three different converging influences. And the first is this: it's post-war apathy. If you remember C.S. Lewis's first apologetic work that caught the attention of James Welch, the head of the BBC's religious broadcasting, The Problem of Pain, Lewis's first apologetic book, is really what started it all, because James Welch was so impressed by that, he asked Lewis to come and deliver a talk on Christianity. But in that book, C.S. Lewis makes this statement: "We can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." Lewis understood that in times of pain, people were acutely sensitive to truth. And in a time of pain like war brings, Lewis spoke directly, and after the war, he changed his approach. So Lewis spoke through God's megaphone. He was faithful to do so in the midst of a time of pain, but when his audience was no longer sensitive to the message, he would strike at their imagination. James Welch, again, he's the one who invited Lewis to speak on the BBC. James Welch estimated that 3/4 of their audience were generally indifferent to Christianity. 3/4 of their audience, of religious broadcasting. Also in the foreword to Dorothy Sayers, I would imagine we have some Dorothy Sayers fans here at the conference as well. In the foreword to Dorothy Sayers' work, The Man Born to be King, James Welch cites a study of British soldiers that estimates, or actually doesn't estimate, it's a hard statistic, that only 23% of the newly enlisted British soldiers heading off to war, only 23% of them understood the meaning of Easter. So C.S. Lewis had his work cut out for them, for him. War, as the song goes, what is it good for? For Lewis, it was good for sharing the gospel, for those who had sensitive ears and searching hearts. So post-war apathy, after the war, Lewis changed his approach. The second stream of influence is fatigue from Lewis's public apologetics, both his success and his failure. This summer, I had the opportunity to take a group of students to London, or to England. We went to London. We also went to Oxford and Cambridge. And we were able to get on the train in Oxford and take it into London. And I was able to share with them this story that I share with you. Lewis would get on that train, the same railways that we got on, from the safety of Oxford. Hitler did not bomb Oxford. He was preserving Oxford, we now know, to make it his capital when he conquered England. And so Oxford was never bombed. That's why the Narnia stories begin with children coming from London, right, to the safety of Oxford. And Lewis would take that train into a city that was constantly being bombed. Lewis put his life on the line to deliver the talks that became Mere Christianity. On the weekends, Lewis was ministering to the Royal Air Force, to men and women. That's how he spent his weekends. During the week, he was lecturing. On the evenings, he was often, when he wasn't drinking with his friends, he was presiding over the Socratic Club, where they were defending the Christian faith. And in fact, in one letter to one of his friends in 1941, Lewis described his apologetic work in this way: "One felt all the time as if one had just played a game of football, aching all over." You should also take note of the 1947 Time cover story in which they made this statement: "Outside his own Christian circle, Lewis is not particularly popular with his Oxford colleagues. Some resent his large student following. Others criticize his cheap performances on the BBC. But their most serious charge is that Lewis's theological pamphleteering is a kind of academic heresy." Lewis was constantly taking attacks because of his apologetics. He felt the pressure of it.
In fact, listen to these lines, powerful lines, from one of Lewis's first public sermons. It's instructive for us to understand this change in Lewis's life. Lewis writes, "We may come to love knowledge, our knowing more than the thing known, to delight not in the exercise of our talents, but in the fact that they are ours, or even in the reputation they bring us. Every success in the scholar's life increases this danger. If it becomes irresistible, he must give up his scholarly work. The time for plucking out the right eye has arrived." Lewis prophetically foresaw a time where the scholar himself, perhaps, would have to step away from such endeavors. Of course, there's the famous debate with the female Catholic philosopher G.E.M. Anscombe, which his biographer Sayer believed that Lewis was defeated publicly. Of course, Lewis will later say he didn't feel as bad as others thought of him. If you read James Comeau's book, At the Breakfast Table, Reflections from Students of Lewis's Who Had Breakfast with Lewis, you'll see that many of them will talk about the fact that in the days following the debate, Lewis was unusually irritable and grumpy and would reference the debate with certainly not fond thoughts. And so you have a public embarrassment, perhaps. Let me just wrap up this second stream before moving to the third by quoting from C.S. Lewis's poem, The Apologist's Evening Prayer. Lewis writes, again, if you've done public apologetics, you can appreciate and resonate with this. Lewis writes, "From all my lame defeats, and oh much more, from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, at which while angels weep, the audience laughs, from all my proofs of thy divinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. From all my thoughts, even from thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free." C.S. Lewis changed his approach after war. As people were no longer as sensitive, he changed his approach as a result, I believe, of both his apologetic success and failure. And then finally, there's an unfinished book he mentions to Carl Henry. And in conclusion, I'll just say a few things about it. In a letter to an Italian priest by the name Don Giovanni Calabria, the letter was written, mind you, in Latin. Don Giovanni was a huge fan of Screwtape letters. He sent Lewis a letter, but because Lewis did not speak Italian and because the Italian priest did not speak English, the only language they shared was Latin. So there's an entire collection of letters between Lewis and this Italian priest, all written in Latin. And here's what C.S. Lewis said in 1952. He said he was having difficulty writing a book on prayer. Quote, "I find many difficulties, nor do I definitely know whether God wishes me to complete my task or not." In 1953, there's a great trip. There's a great story, true story. C.S. Lewis and Martin Lloyd-Jones were both on a boat to Ireland. Martin Lloyd-Jones asked C.S. Lewis, "When we have another book like Mere Christianity?" To which C.S. Lewis responded, "When I discover the meaning of prayer." In 1953, Lewis wrote his friend, Sister Penelope, and he said, "I am still working on my book on prayer." And then in 1954, he wrote her again and he said, "I have had to abandon the book on prayer. It was clearly not for me." And in his letter to Carl Henry, he says that the last theological work he committed himself to had to be abandoned. C.S. Lewis did finish his book on prayer 6 months before he died. And it all came together when he put it in the context of a fictional conversation between he and a make-believe friend, letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. Those are the three streams of influence, I believe: post-war apathy, apologetic success and failure, and then finally this book on prayer. The publishers took an excerpt out of that book and sent it out to friends of the author and the publisher, and the title of the book is Beyond the Bright Blur. There are only 350 copies of it made. I'm going to read just something from it, and I'll be auctioning this book off after my talk. I do have a copy of one of the 350 supposed copies they made. And inside the book, it simply says, "Beyond the Bright Blur is taken from Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer, by C.S. Lewis, which will be published in the year 1964. This limited edition is published as a New Year's greeting to friends of the author and his publisher. This was not to be, as the creator of Narnia took his last breath.
on November 22, 1963, and crossed over to meet the emperor beyond the sea. I think if one were listening for it, a lion's roar might have been heard from that old wardrobe in Oxford, England, that very moment so many years ago. C.S. Lewis deployed a direct apologetic during times of war and focused on smuggling the gospel after the war was over. Though Britain was at peace, Lewis continued to fight another battle until his death in 1963. Like the deep magic of Narnia, this battle was not with flesh and blood, but with powers and principalities. From wartime talks to talking fawns, his excellent life was committed to the advancement of the gospel. And though dead, yet still he speaks. Thank you.